Welcome back. This is the pregame show, and I'm so pleased to have on one of my favorite writers. Chuck Billington is not only an accomplished writer, a huge baseball fan, but he is also a terrific researcher. His latest book, I'm holding in my hand, Comiskey Park's Last World Series, A History of the Chicago 1959 Chicago White Sox, Charles N. Billington. He happens to have my favorite player on the cover in a fabulous picture, obviously safe at second base, Louis Aparicio. Chuck, how are you?
Thanks so much, Rick. I'm fine. How are you?
This book, you know, I'm a fan of your work. This book really got to me, and it's not simply because I'm, you know, fanatic about the great Mr. Aparicio, but I think you get to it in the dedication, too. You write, "For all the fans of the Chicago White Sox who put Mantle and Berra in their spokes and Fox and Pierce under their pillows, you know who you are." It is, you reaffirm for me what a remarkable and unique place this team has for a solid couple of generations of Chicagoans. I hate to ask you, you talk about, you know, the different fan bases, and you say, "I became interested in this team as an elementary school youngster." Being interested in this team and being fanatic about the team, were you a Cubs fan, Chuck?
I grew up as a Cubs fan, and as I got older, I got more and more interested in both teams. And one of the things that kind of turned the tide for my interest in both teams was the 59 White Sox. And also, I think the fact that the White Sox, you know, I'm through the mind of a child now, they played in the American League. The American League had teams like the Tigers, and it had blockbuster teams like the Yankees. Whereas the Cubs, you know, I remember turning the Tribune upside down with my friends just to see what it would feel like to have the Cubs in first place and the Phillies in second and the Pirates in third, instead of always having them sixth, seventh, and eighth like we had. It almost seemed like the Cubs played in a junior league and the White Sox played in a major league, even though in those days, you know, the National League was much more quick to integrate.
And oh, no question.
In many ways, the stellar players in the 50s.
Oh, they were much quicker to integrate, except for the Mr. Wrigley. That's for another book, and you've got that other book. You know, just the names evoke, I'm just going to hear them. Louis Aparicio, Nellie Fox, Sherm Lawler, Jim Landis, Jim Rivera. Not only was it a great defensive team, it was a team of interesting characters, too.
Yes, certainly, yeah.
And what you have chapters that take on each of the games in the World Series. The book follows month to month the quest of this team to have Quinn set off the fire alarms. But also, you've done a remarkable job, because I didn't really know. I knew. I'm going to tell you a little secret. I had my 10th birthday party at Comiskey. My mother had become somehow, I don't know how or why or how, friendly with Hank Greenberg, who was one of the owners of the team for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the team was so under my skin, but I had no idea. And did you, about the kind of business and financial strum and drang that this team went through?
They went. There was a lot of cover-up on that. However, it would all of the lawsuits, and I try to do a very careful job of explaining to the readers the 10 lawsuits between February 1957 and October 1959 between either Chuck Comiskey and his sister, or Chuck Comiskey and the SBC syndicate, which was headed by Bill Veeck and bought Comiskey's sister's majority shares from him to control the team. That kind of underlined the entire background of the book, because there was also a lot of arguments between Veeck and Comiskey over what kind of a team to have. Veeck always loved power hitters, and he said, "How in the world can we win a pennant? How can we go anywhere without any power hitters?" Chuck Comiskey, along with Frank Lane and his brother-in-law at the time, when they got along, Johnny Rigney, they built a team based on a dead ball era stadium, a team that was fast, a team that could field, and a team that could pitch. The White Sox were the last team to win the World Series, to steal more bases, then hit home runs. 94 home runs, 113
yeah,
stolen
I
bases.
Love that, too. I love it. It takes, I mean, it really is. I mean, of course, it's a different era, Chuck Billington.
Yeah.
But you do such a, I think, a remarkable job of capturing what that team meant to that neighborhood. This was a neighborhood ballpark, right?
Right. And I tried to dedicate, I have an entire chapter dealing with, you know, the kind of the social and sociological implications of Bridgeport and Canaryville and what the White Sox meant to the South Side. Remember that their founder, Charles Comiskey, for many years would only put ballplayers with Irish last names on the team.
I know.
And this really was a neighborhood team like the Brooklyn Dodgers. As were their tenants, the Chicago Cardinals, who I pay, I think, just desserts to as they left Comiskey Park in 1959, searching for that elusive dollar that they never really earned in Chicago before they moved to St. Louis. But the identity of the Bridgeport locals with the team was such a strong bond. The head of the Chicago Police Department at the Bridgeport station, which is right there at 35th Street Lowe, he took it upon himself to be Casey Stengel's personal bodyguard when they came, when the Yankees came to the stadium. Mayor Daley, of course, Chicago White Sox, Mayor Daley Sr., Chicago White Sox fan number one, made a huge point of going to the games, knowing the players, and so on and so forth. And then all of a sudden, this outsider with very, very innovative business ideas, but kind of a baseball maverick, Bill Veeck, gets to run the team. And he has all of these very fascinating theories about concessions, about team building, about baseball. And very, very unlike a baseball owner in the 1950s, he's speaking in front of the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago and giving them
exactly.
their theories. He's trying to figure out a way. He figured out that in those days, believe it or not, the White Sox made as much money from concessions as they did from their road games. And he thought, well, if I could just keep the fans in the park a little longer.
Yeah, yeah.
If we can keep them in the park a little longer, we can boost the concessions. And he worked out a theory about fireworks, how to keep people in the stands with fireworks. And it's not, oh, I know everybody loves a fireworks social, we'll have fireworks after the game. It was all based on his very early but kind of innovative market designs on more sales.
He no question. You have
fireworks after a loss was a 40% increase in concession sales.
Well, I love the concession sales thing.
Fireworks was 50%, but a win followed by fireworks 150% more sales.
Unbelievable.
In concessions than otherwise.
Well, you do a nice job of, you have, as I go to your research abilities, there were two ticket prices for all regular season games, $2.50 for a box seat and $2 for the grandstand. Fans had a choice of the following beverages: milk, 20 cents, hot chocolate, 25 cents, small coffee, 15 cents, orange drink, 15, lemonade, 25 cents, Pepsi Cola, 15 cents, and typically beer, Hams beer, the most expensive at 40 cents. I'm on the phone.
Right.
Chuck, we've got to take a little break. I'm on the phone with Chuck Billington, the author of a number of books, but most recently and most... you've really outdone yourself with this one.
Okay.
Comiskey Park's Last World Series, A History of the 59 Chicago White Sox. This is the pregame show. The Sox are playing Cleveland, and we will be back in 2 minutes. I'm going to end this afternoon show with Chuck Billington and before the Sox game, because he's written Comiskey Park's Last World Series, A History of the 1959 Chicago White Sox, that is filled, Chuck, with so many interesting people, characters. I'm going to get to a couple in a second, but I want your assessment of Al Lopez as a manager. He always, to me, certainly as a child in the face of Louis Aparicio, seemed sort of colorless to me. Was he a good manager?
He was, in many ways, he seemed to be kind of a colorless guy because he was up against some stiff competition.
Yeah, no kidding.
In the colorfulness department in those days. You know, you had Leo DeRocher in New York City. You had Casey Stengel in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Casey Stengel was kind of the, you know, the beloved buffoon of baseball. I'm not disparaging his intelligence or his baseball acumen, but he also had incredibly great teams fed by a minor league team, a major league team that acted like a minor league team, the Kansas City Athletics.
Mm-hmm.
That's a book in itself in terms of how the Athletics kept feeding the Yankees their best players. But Al Lopez from 1950 to 1959 never finished lower than second place.
Wow.
And took two teams to the pennant.
Wow.
His winning percentage is for nine years is .584.
Whoa.
We've all been impressed, and justifiably so, with the job Joe Maddon did in Chicago.
Yeah.
Imagine that same job, finishing second place or first place in an eight-team league.
Yeah.
9 years in a row.
Amazing. The other character in this who you brought back, I had no idea, for instance, that Hank Greenberg, the legendary, the greatest Jewish ball player in history, was married to the heiress of the Gimbel's department store fortune.
Carol, C-A-R-A-L, Carol Gimbel. And Hank Greenberg were quite the couple in the early 50s, and they divorced.
Yeah.
He was picked by Bill Veeck to help run the Cleveland Ball Club back in the late 40s. Veeck thought the world of Greenberg, wanted a baseball player in his decision-making realm. He made a lot of money for Greenberg because every team that Veeck sold, he sold for a big profit. But Greenberg, at the time, he was kind of living a madman existence. He was divorced from Miss Gimbel. He, for reasons unknown to me, got custody of the children.
Uh-huh.
And to be fair with her, took an apartment in Manhattan where she insisted on staying and would fly on weekends to Chicago to help run the White Sox, lived in the executive house at the time.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Kind of a harried existence. Greenberg was a very physically imposing man as well. He was at least 6'4".
Yeah.
Trim, but athletically built. He and Chuck Comiskey got along like oil and water.
Comiskey
was the legacy heir of the team, so he thought, and in many ways justifiably so. He and Greenberg were constantly at swords points. At one point, Comiskey offered to make peace with Veeck if Greenberg would go, and of course Veeck said no to that. I also had the very good fortune, and still have the good fortune of knowing Mrs. Veeck.
Oh, how nice.
Who is a very, very impressive.
I just want to read. I want to read one. Talking about, you know, one of the things, the ball players. We know the ball players, but behind the scenes here, after they've won, you write in June. I just want you to hear these names, ladies and gentlemen. In June 1961, Bernard Epton, a 39-year-old LaSalle Street attorney and longtime Comiskey acquaintance, offered Veeck's group a generous $4.8 million for their 54% of the team, an amount that put the franchise's value at $8.9. Epton had formed a partnership with comedian and television star Danny Thomas.
Right. Veeck and Thomas always wanted to get into baseball.
Veeck and Greenberg put off Epton and Thomas until June 6th when they rejected the offer. There are so many interesting characters and fascinating business stories floating through this thing.
The business end of it is a big part of the history of that team and also of that era of baseball.
Sure, but also of why the Sox, you know, didn't become the Yankees. Let's say, for instance,
exactly.
The other great thing is everybody of a certain age in this town remembers, you know, that night they won, and Chicago Fire Commissioner Robert Quinn. Carried away by the euphoria of the night, had taken it upon himself to activate Chicagoland's 110 air raid sirens at full volume. You have really been able to, Chuck Billington, bring this team back in all of its colorful facets, I would put it that way. Who, if you had to pick a former Cubs fan, who's your favorite player on that team?
Without question, for me, it would probably be Nellie Fox or perhaps his roommate, Billy Pierce.
Yeah.
I had the very good fortune. Billy Pierce passed away about 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
And he was extremely helpful in feeding me information and talking to me willingly all the time about this team and about the history of the team. Nellie Fox is quite a character.
Yep.
This is somebody who... he's smaller than two-thirds of the people listening to your show, and Connie Mack gave up on him when he was a teenager after he had dropped out of, I believe, eighth grade to be a professional baseball player. the White Sox picked him up for a song and a dance. He became the White Sox leading player. Only one other player in modern history struck out with less frequency, and that was Lloyd Wehner. Fox's strikeout ratio was about one for every 40 games.
That's astonishing.
Now, yeah, and you know, the team itself, it's a different game than it was.
No question.
I dare say it was a better game. People didn't either walk, strike out, or hit home runs.
Yeah.
They had the team, it struck out 634 times during the season, but they had 1,325 hits. And they had more walks. The batting order had more walks than it did strikeouts. That's unheard of. I mean, imagine if somebody like Adam Dunn or Alfonso Soriano had statistics like that today. It's unheard of.
Well, and also the pitchers too. Pitchers would the unheard of thing these days of pitching a complete game. There were no pitch counts. Right. I mean, if Billy Pierce said, Al, my arm hurts, then he maybe would take him out. That's one of the great things about your book, Chuck, and I don't mean to go so overboard on it, but it's less than 200 pages, and it reads like a, I know what happened. I mean, I know what happened,
yeah,
and you've written it in a really thrilling manner. And again, the business aspect of it, the business and sort of, I don't want to make it sound, the sociological aspect of it, too, the whole Bridgeport kind of thing.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I very much wanted to point out what a big component of Chicago's economic prestige having two teams was in those days, and how, you know, the White Sox dominated all through the 50s. From 1950 to 1967, they outdrew the Cubs all except for one year in 1958. And the implications of a World Series on the South Side went so far as that even the CTA took out ads boasting and hoping for a Milwaukee Braves Chicago White Sox pennant because their revenues were in the doldrums. And of course, if they took, people could take the North Shore line, which is an extension of the CTA from Comiskey Park all the way to County Stadium if they wanted. And then the CTA of all organizations saw that as a possible revenue boon.
That's fabulous. What do you think of the current team? I mean, I know it's a different era and all that stuff, but I do think that the Sox winning again, and it has not been as long as since the Cubs, would do wonders for this town.
Yeah, it would. It really would. There's been, I don't want to say so many missteps, but there's been so much misfortune with the White Sox. Most recently, they've had some very, very high draft choices, very promising young guys whose careers have ended because of injuries or who've been sidelined because of injuries. They got a new stadium, and then, of course, at first the upper deck was a complete disaster.
Yeah.
Should they have put it there, or should they have put it in the South Loop closer to
downtown,
Roosevelt Road track? Who knows? But I think the fact that, Chicago, I don't want to, I'll be honest about it, Chicago's had kind of a losing streak in some ways the last half decade or so, and we still have two baseball teams. Now, that means absolutely nothing in the grand scheme of things, but, we're really the only city that has two baseball teams in the city. Los Angeles doesn't.
Right.
New York has teams in different boroughs.
Yeah.
It's a whole different thing, and it means a lot. Now, this season, of course, is a disaster with the COVID, and perhaps we can get past these teams that don't know what they're doing, like St. Louis and Miami, and finish the season. And what would happen if both the Cubs and the White Sox went deep into the playoffs?
Oh, my God. Do you still watch baseball?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I watch it. I don't follow pitch by pitch every inning, but it kind of gets into your system. One of the wonderful things about baseball is that it follows three of the seasons in the climates that we have throughout most of the country. And, many people mark the seasons with baseball, and baseball itself marks the seasons as well, I think.
Well, you could do nothing, you people out there listening, tuning in before the pregame show, Sox versus Cleveland. You could do nothing better than to, in the next week or two, get a copy of Comiskey Park's Last World Series, A History of the 1959 Chicago White Sox by Charles N. Billington. It is a book that deserves to be on the bookshelf of everyone who loves Chicago history and who loves baseball. Chuck, congratulations. It's really remarkable. And go tune in the game right now, okay?
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Rick, and best to you now.
Thank you. You too. It really is a good book. They don't have Louis Aparicio, but they seem to have a number of good young players. Fingers crossed, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening to the Afternoon After Hours.